Blog Talk Radio.
The Corona man.
Who got you,
the Corona man got me. The Corona man. The Corona man.
Good morning.
Got me. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I've been in the same room for 11, almost 9 or 10 days now. I done rearranged it. I done tried on clothes that I was too fat to fit before the Rona man got me. I done redid my hair. Well, I might need his son to visit again maybe later on in the year. But
his cousin and I need to come through one more time.
His cousin might not, just on the lower half, though. You can get Corona on your, I need Corona from the waist down.
Lord
have mercy. Yeah, man, I can't even imagine where. I mean, maybe the gym, or when I took myself out to dinner a week or so ago, I can't even imagine, because I sit up in the house, you know, I'm a home person, so I don't know where he got me, but that oriental bastard and ran up on me and kung-fu'd me in the back of the neck.
That's racist as shit, right? Yeah, on so many levels. I apologize to the Asian brothers and sisters.
He got me.
Mm-mm-mm.
I'm here, I'm recovering. I'm on day number. Let me look the length of my mustache. I think I'm on day number 9.
So do you think?
I don't even know what day it is. Oh, it's Saturday. It's definitely Saturday because I'm calling in. Because other than that, I don't know what day it is no more.
So do you think it's time to put down the mask? You know, you think mandates are not the way to go, or you think mandates are the way to go?
I am the mask. Listen, not only was I was sleeping in a damn mask. I have decorative masks. Mm-hmm. I have masks with the filter in it. I got masks that I was spraying hand sanitizer on. I'm not much of a toucher, even with doors, I'm one of them people who will pull my sleeve down and pull the door open with the sleeve instead of my hand. And when I leave doors, you know, if I can push them open with my back, I just lean against it and walk out with my back.
Yeah.
I am one of those people.
Hold on 1 second. Shout out to Golden Corral. And, you know, this isn't a shameless plug for them to, you know, for you all to run up in their business or nothing like that. But before this even went down, Golden Corral had the hooks for your arm so you could open the door. You know what I'm saying? Shout out to them for foreseeing anything like this years and years and years ago. I think more doors need to be that way. You know what I'm saying? Like, we have way too many.
They're going to do the open slide like the grocery store is what most people going to have to do, what the grocery store is doing. And, I mean, if you don't have that, I think I saw in Japan or something, you can step on a pedal. You step on this panel, and it'll pop the door open for you or something. But, I mean, I'm one of those people.
I'm
a hand sanitizer.
You can design your restroom to where it doesn't even need a door. You just make a corner into it, and you just walk in. Like, Walmart has those restrooms.
Like
right.
Mm-hmm.
And Costco has the same thing. So, right, there's a corner, so that's the barrier that you need. So, you know, so we need to look at this thing differently, for real. But there are too many doors that we have to pull on.
The person architect or interior designer right now who comes with that anti-infectious architecture or I don't know how to, you know, healthy, health-conscious architecture, they're going to make a killing. Because so far, we just don't do it. You're absolutely right, Lise. Whoever is going to push us past this next turning knobs, pushing levers, sliding doors back, all that, where all of us are grabbing the same point in order to make something happen, that's got to change. That's absolutely got to change. I'm getting better. I'm trying to make sure I don't become, you know, patient. I can't be patient zero. Somebody had to get me. But I don't, you know, want to be patient one that spreads it to the rest of the people in my household or whatever. And so I've been just trying to be super diligent. But let me tell you, it's not the illness. I am outside. I get up and go somewhere, you know. If I don't do nothing else, I'll get up and go walk my block like a sociopath, you know. And for me not to be able to hit the streets, you know, and then when I wanted to go to the store and I had to apologize, told them to spray my money, and I had to do all this shit just so I could not feel guilty about needing to go buy me something to eat. You know what I'm saying? So we got a lot of behavior that we're gonna have to modify, and it's not just not to get sick. It's this stuff we can't do no more. We done high fiving. We done, you know, just.
Give me some skin.
I have figured it out. It's a lot of behavior that we're going to have to cut out, Lee, if, you know, we don't want to just keep finding ourselves in and out of quarantine.
So, you know, the reality is this thing is here for the long term. I mean, you said that a couple weeks ago. You know, like any other virus, it's not going anywhere. It's going to continue to mutate. It's going to continue to do this, that, and the third, but it's not going anywhere. It is with us ever, like luggage. As you just hit on, how do we live with it so that it does not constantly shut us up, shut us down? You know, I canceled 2 trips within a week's time. I was supposed to be in London for New Year's, then I was coming back home for a couple of days, and then I was supposed to be in Puerto Rico. Actually, now. I'm actually supposed to be in Puerto Rico right now. And I canceled that, too, just because it's just not the move to make right now in any way, shape, or form. So how do we readjust our thinking to live with it? Now, you know, shout out to my man Jeff. You know, Jeff is a huge supporter of the show. And Jeff is like, yo, it's time to burn the mask. I get it, though. You know what I'm saying? But with folks dropping right, left, left, right, this might not be the time to do that, but it is time to learn how to live with this situation. How can we
still have a semblance of life as we once knew it, even under these conditions. And yes, it is time to get real about that. It is time to have those open and honest discussions. You know, it is time to say, you know, hey, you're vaxxed, I'm vaxxed, but hell, we still might be infected, and we not know it. And if that happens, then, you know, shit, it happens. But we did everything we could to prevent one another from getting sick. But at some point, the masks are going to come off. The masks are going to come down. If it's just sharing a meal. And then there's other times when masks are not appropriate. You know what I'm going on there? And, you know, it's like, if
no,
that happens, what happens? You know what I'm saying? Well, yeah, you don't know.
That's because you act like a nun, you know, I mean, that is what it is. But some of us are not behaving like such, and it's going to happen. You know,
like,
this
disease, mm-hmm. this illness, it makes me really, like, remember back in the HIV AIDS days, you know, when people were like, don't touch me, don't look at me. You know, it's like we switched the reactions. The reaction we should have had to AIDS, which was, you know, protect yourself, just be cool, it's going to be all right, you know, we're going to live through this. That's what we gave to Corona. And the don't touch me, leave me alone behavior that we should that we had with AIDS, we should have that now with the Corona. We didn't switch our, you know, behavior. As far as, but I tell you what, Lee, you ain't going to want to keep getting Corona. You understand? This is not something that, it's not like a one-time thing. You can get Corona over and over again, depending on which one you get. And all it takes is one or two mutations of the one you already had, and then you can get reinfected with that motherfucker again. So, what can we possibly change in our lifestyle? I mean, are we finna stop touching, period? Because husbands are giving it to wives. They bringing it home from work, you know. Wives are giving them to the children. They bringing it home from work. What can we do? Lee, what would you suggest we do if we really wanted to curtail this behavior, you know, make a serious, honest change with Corona? What would you suggest?
I have no suggestions at this time, to be honest with you. Well, that's not true. What would I suggest? I would suggest that we follow the advice that Rodney gave last week, which is we have to pony up along with other developed nations and inoculate the non-developed nations, because most of these variants are occurring in under-vaccinated nations. That does not prevent every variant from happening. No, it does not. But I think it would curb down the speed at which these variants are occurring if we did vaccinate these underdeveloped nations. So that's number one. We really have to get serious about that. Then the second thing we have to get serious about is a mask mandate. It doesn't have to be forever. But we need to give the inoculations an opportunity to work. So a 60, 90-day mask mandate after everyone's inoculated, you know, really give this thing no place to go, shut it down as best we can. Again, it's not going to be 100% because at some point you have to eat and drink. So you have to take off the mask at some point. You have to let down the mask at some point. So, you know, but that risk is highly mitigated, I would say, depleted, versus you just walking around and everybody just breathing like this shit ain't real, and then, you know, no one's getting sick and nobody's not. Now, the biggest issue with Omarion, why folks saying he said the Omicron? You know, how is it Omarion? You know what I'm saying? It's just ridiculous. Why we call stuff out of every name except what
it's called? Because we can't. If you give it a serious name, then it ensues panic. One of the very key mechanisms of black people is you have to make fun of it if it hurts. The more it hurts, the more fun you better make of it. I mean, or else we'd still be paralyzed with analysis. We just have to laugh at it first and then try to work on it. But, yeah, Well, it's Omicron in my household, but I know what you're talking about, Omarion.
Yeah, Omicron, right, Omicron, is that it's not really taking people out. It's making them sick, but it's not really taking them out. It's not killing a boatload of people, unlike the other variants. So, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's not really that bad. And now the sense is, oh, well, it's getting better. No, motherfucker, it's not. It's actually getting worse. You know what I'm saying? Because there's a new variant that I was reading about just yesterday that I think it was seen in Europe for the first time a couple of days ago. I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy. It's just and it's not further down the scale. Actually, it's back on the scale. I think it began with the F. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I'll look it up in a second. But yeah, here we go with this shit again. You know, there's always something. There's always a hit. There's another hit. Then there's another hit. Then there's another hit. There's always something. So yeah, man, it's just one of them situations where we gotta knuckle down, lock it up just for a second, let this dust settle as best it can, because, you know, as we all know, some dust will always be in the air, but let the dust settle as best it can, then come out and go, okay, this is our baseline, let's move on here, you know, versus us chasing another vaccine or another booster and another booster and another booster and another booster in infinity for something that we didn't take seriously on the front end. So the vaccines and the boosters, yeah, they did serve well, but they would have served even better had we really started from a worldwide baseline. You know, so, yeah, it's nice for us to have 85-95% of our people inoculated. That's cool. But if it's 3% of the people inoculated in this country, then it makes no damn sense. This is an airborne virus. It's going to find somebody to infect. It's going to mutate, and then here we go again. It's going to come back and attack you. It's an airborne virus. We cannot live without air. That doesn't work. That does not compute. So, yeah, that's what I would suggest. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, most people don't like me to hear this, to say this, but I'm telling you, I think this is biological warfare we're undergoing right now. And I only say that because there were people suffering with this virus on the planet for almost 5 or 6, damn near a decade, Lee, and we just never said nothing about it. Them Chinese people have been suffering with corona. Well, let's say this better, SARS, right? Because corona, and this is what I really want people to hear, they're doing their best not to say it. Corona is a variation of the SARS virus. And SARS, they was over there working with SARS in China for so long that we was actually making fun of them for wearing the mask because they didn't tell us why they was wearing them. Like most Chinese people would not tell you, listen, we're here because, you know, you can't be in China without a mask. In some parts of the mask, because SARS is already what it's doing here, it had already ransacked China the way it's doing here. So I'm of the opinion that until China is feeling like they have killed off a sufficient number of the rest of the planet, and that's when they will release whatever it is they got over there to stop it from running through the planet like this. I truly believe that this is government related. This is biological warfare. And it might be because I'm on day 9 and I got my conspiracy theories taking over at this point. But I do remember clearly watching footage like back in the day when Michael Jackson went to China. And everybody at the concert damn near had on a mask. And then we was making fun of Michael Jackson for wearing his mask. And I was like, well, what's going on? You know, nobody said, well, why is everybody over there got on a mask? Only, you know, real serious thinkers were thinking on that level. Now
But that's common in the Asian culture. The wearing of masks is common to prevent the spread of colds and or other disease. But I get your point. I definitely get where you're going with it because, you know, I've been saying for years.
Nobody was wearing a ask for them. You might have found a couple of Indians in them, Eastern, the real Indians, not Native Americans.
Right, right.
But right. On the whole planet, nobody was working with a wide-scale epidemic like that, trying to do something about it but China. And so I'm like, why? I mean, I guess it ain't no power in pointing fingers and saying, look what y'all did. But if you the one who broke it, shouldn't you be part of the team that fix it? Like, you mean to tell me all them years that they were suffering with SARS, China don't have nothing for SARS? I mean, why they sit there holding? You mean to tell me all them dang Chinese people over there are just they victims to every SARS variant that ever came, just held within China?
Right.
Somebody knows what to do with this virus. Somebody knows. And I just feel like we suffering on a global scale for something that elite people, they know about, and they just kind of like, well, we're going to keep ourselves safe. The elites are.
Right.
They not even do it. They not even it, because everybody, all them stars got corona too. Whoopee.
Yep.
I mean, you know, everybody got corona. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like a global, this is a global global biochemical warfare, though. I do not in my heart think that this is an accident only because they suffered with SARS and SARS variations in China for almost a decade before the rest of the planet did. So if you've been suffering with this shit for 10 years plus, you mean to tell me y'all ain't found nothing that can help? So since y'all didn't find nothing that can help and y'all was tired of being the only casualties to the virus, they went on ahead and released it to the rest of the planet and see, so that they're not the only one taking on, you know, loss of life.
And or the R&D to figure out a cure for it.
Exactly. Now,
I can see I can see that line of thinking. I don't think I'm agreeing with it, but I can see that line of thinking.
Hey, I know I'm sounding far-fetched. Every time I sit down too long thinking about who and why somebody does something, it becomes a weird point with me, because I'm not big on conspiracy theory for real. But the point of the matter is, Lee, how many years of dying did Oriental and Chinese people in those nations around there do? How many years of dying did they do with SARS? And they didn't even for real say, hey, y'all, we got this virus over here that's running our ass ragged. Y'all be careful out there. They didn't even say nothing. I don't ever remember no Chinese president coming on the news saying, listen, we have been suffering in our nation for blah, 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 blah amount of time with some blah, blah, blah. We are afraid we are unable to keep it contained to our region. The rest of the world needs to be ready to deal with with something new. Because this ain't even like the flu. You know what I'm saying? New version of the flu, we all know that's for the most part man-made, even though we have been playing biochemical warfare with the influenza virus too. But the flu we know, rhinoviruses we know, those are all nature occurring. Who's the SARS cousin? Who's SARS related to?
Okay.
We can't even go and dig up the genealogy of the SARS virus to see how they talking about bats. They never did agree to that. They never agreed to bats, rats, cats, or any reason why this is ravishing the planet. We can say, listen, please stop killing us. I get it. You know. And China, one of the reasons why, why would China do that, you say to yourself? Well, they have put themselves under sanction, under birth sanction. For like 20-some years, they've been working on that one child rule, right? After they did the one child, and it got their population to whatever it got it to, then the SARS variation start coming through and you know, really running a number on their population. they probably looked up and said, uh-oh, you know, we ain't the most people no more. And they not. African children are the most people on the planet.
Huh.
There are more African descendants under the age of 21 on this planet than any other race of people or nation of people. And it's because they let age run their game on us.
Right.
And so all them old Africans is dead, right? All these new mm-hmm. babies with antibodies already built in a system to AIDS and HIV is here now. So what are we going to do? How are we going to be the most people again? Because there's power in being the most people on the planet. Nobody want to go to war with the biggest nation
most
on the
people.
Planet.
Right.
Right. Nobody with the most people. So how are we going to get to be the most people again? Let's see. And then they really probably... Because it's not killing Africans the way they probably wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not killing the way they wanted to. We the contenders for the most people. We the contenders.
Well,
and I want people not to be mad at or trying. You know, not I'm not trying to look at that stuff started up where we beating up Oriental people no more. None of that. I just want people to understand that the way this thing is spreading, this is not even how regular disease mostly spread around a planet. Tuberculosis, you know, all them, the plague didn't even spread like this.
The funny thing, going back to your point about the one child rule, right? So now, because you're right. The society's getting old, they are collapsing, and they recognize that. So now they're like, okay, well, we need to import people to help our population, to take care of the old people in general. Who are they importing to help? Black people. They've gone to Africa and have imported Africans in order to help maintain their society. Now, what's going to happen for that? We're going right back to the root of civilization, because now you're going to have Ying and Abasola. Now you're going to have Jet Li and that's not true. I would say Ming Li and... Mufasa, you know. Now you're going to have these mixed babies. There's going to be a whole lot of black Chinese kids running around next 20, 30 years, a whole lot of them. You were saying, I'm sorry.
We've done this before. We've created alliances with nations in order to bring them back from the brink of extinction. The problem here is this. Whenever we align ourselves with other nations, we let go of our Africanness. And that's what I'm worried about. I'm really worried about people divesting themselves from the idea of the power of Africana. And so when we team up with all these different nations, when we go and pull China out from their birth dearth, when we pull Europe out of its birth dearth, it does not mean that they buy into Africana and be happy that our genealogy was there to save them. It only means that they do their best to de-Africanize the people that came to save them. I mean, this is what's happening in Rio. This is what happened in Brazil. The more, you know, Brazilians, Portuguese, European Brazilians, they probably don't even for real exist. But whenever they can get, you know, an African to come and give birth and inseminate them and rebuild their family lineage, those people do not come out as Africana versions of the ethnicity they say. They just give up on it and become Brazilian. Yeah. They become Chinese. They become Italian. They become whatever those other people are. And so that's the problem. When you give up, you and become them. But I do agree with Mr. Rodney. We can move on because it's not going to fix itself anytime soon. We are definitely going to be dealing with this for the next 5, maybe even 10 years before we can start talking about being post-viral age, you know, the age of where the virus was the most important thing we were doing.
Well, I mean, again, going back to the point, the virus is here. The virus will be here with us for a very long time. I don't want that to get lost in translation from everything else that was said. What we need to do is learn how to live with the virus. That is where we are right now, and we have to understand and get a bead on what that's going to look like and what that's going to take. And the only way to do that, again, is, in my opinion, because you asked my opinion, that's how we went off on the tangent, to get these underserved countries, underdeveloped countries, vaccines so that we can go from there, solidify a baseline, and then move on. And the only way to do that is that we stop this infighting about stupidity, about what to wear a mask, when not to wear a mask, who should wear it. It's all irrelevant. The most relevant thing right now is we need to get everybody as possible. Again, there's always going to be a small population that's not. We need to get as many people as possible inoculated. We need to then go with the mask mandate, 60 to 90 days, give an opportunity for the vaccination to actually take hold and effect. And then we can go from there. And, you know, hopefully those moves would make the boosters, the vaccines, very effective so that we can go from this yo-yo of, okay, we have mask mandates. We don't have mask mandates. You don't have to wear a mask. Yeah, you do wear that. Well, you don't have to wear a mask if you're vaccinated. Well, it doesn't matter what your vaccination status is. You still got to wear all that crap. Yeah, we can move away from all that crap and get back to what is as close to how things used to be, or the quote unquote norm. Rodney, you got something to add on that part about the making sure the inoculations get to as many people as possible throughout the world, not just within the nation's bounds?
So good morning, Sister Rashi. Good morning, Brother Lee. And to all of our wonderful listeners, thank you all for being here. I do think that the discussion on vaccines and masks is a good discussion to have. There are some things that have been proven and some things that have not been proven, like masks have been proven to work. There is no ambiguity with wearing the mask. And this is something that Black people throughout the diaspora need to get a grip on, is masks work. And there is nothing wrong with wearing a mask. As a matter of fact, you put the appropriate mask on, and then get you a nice decorated cloth mask. You know how we do it. And next thing you know, masks will be the rave
the new
of
fashion
the upper
statement.
Crust. Yes, it'll
there
be a
go.
Fashion statement that they'll make a bunch of money on while we're still talking about should we even wear a mask. So masks work. Wear the mask. And as media people, we have a responsibility to share facts. Now, we can talk opinion because it's an opinion show. Right. But there is a time of seriousness to share facts. And the facts are the vaccine works as vaccines work. The masks work as they are telling us that the masks work. And there's plenty of empirical data to prove that. So please, everybody, in this new year, do not let the conspiracy theorists these anti-vax, anti-mask people cause you to get sick, and not just get sick, but maybe spread it to somebody that you love, and you have to watch them suffer under that illness and or watch them die when you could have simply put on a mask to prevent it. So I hope that we will accept the reality as that reality is what you stated, that diseases like this, viruses like this, tend not to go away. And the flu is a great example. The common cold is another example. We're going to have it, so, and we are going to have to learn to live with it. But we cannot live with it while we're dying from it at the rates that we're dying from, obviously. None of them people live because they're dead, right? And we're not going to be able to live successfully with it with whole industries being affected by people who are sick or who just don't want to put themselves in the line of sight of the viral bullet. And that's the president doesn't have to mandate a closure. We're seeing a very slow drawdown that could be a shutdown because people are not taking this thing serious enough, getting the vaccines, the boosters, which should be considered part of the vaccination process, and trying to stop from hugging and kissing on everybody and going to these large or larger close-quartered inside gatherings. Don't let Trump kill you. He tried it on 1/6 and was unsuccessful in killing us, but don't allow them to cause you to kill yourself or your loved one. So that's what I have to say about that topic.
I want to slide over to 1/6 since you mentioned it. And, you know, we're at 1/8 today, 2 days removed from the anniversary of the insurrection on the Capitol. President Biden gave a hell of a speech just the other day, 24 minutes long and some seconds, about the insurrection and how inept or how well the former president coached the folks whom were the invaders on our nation's capital, and how close they actually came to taking over the chambers. And he didn't go in detail into that part, but that's something that we've discussed offline. I felt like, as I'm listening to the speech, I'm like, this is too late. This is something that I would have rather heard from him about 6 months ago. But I understood why they waited to this moment. I understood because two reasons. First off, the symbolism, right? It's an anniversary, blah, 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 blah. But secondly, the January 6th Commission is actually starting to get some damn teeth. And there's some real revelations coming out and news stories day in and day out, you know, the stories about how Trump literally sat in a dining room off of the West Wing and watched the television of the events instead of hopping into action and shutting it down. How he sat there for nearly an hour and just watched, but said nothing, did nothing whatsoever. How Hannity text messages were going back and forth, how other folks' text messages were going back and forth. I mean, a lot of this stuff is very heavy stuff. It's very incriminating stuff. The question is, though, with the 2022 elections looming, with gerrymandering, with the
redistricting?
The redistricting, thank you. I'm trying to think of a term. Redistricting operating at warp speed. Will the commission be able to continue its work before it runs aground? Because if the Democrats lose
their positions in the House, will the Republicans take up the charge? I doubt it. I really doubt it. I don't see it happening. I see this thing being dead on arrival and us being close to funny, I'm about to use this analogy, but it's like the voyage of Columbus. You know, he got close to the New World, but really didn't get there. He really didn't get to America. You know, he got to the Caribbean, and that was it. And I think that the commission would be the same. I think it would get to the Caribbean, and then it would run us under. That would be it. It would never fully make it to the New World. However, I don't even think that people would pick it up in a fashion where they would get credit for actually bringing closure based on its current findings. I think it would just die a very slow, painful, and public death, because I think the Republicans would just come in and shut it down immediately, because it would shed so much negative light upon them and their ineptitude. What do you think about that, Rod?
Well, I have no doubt that they will shut it down. I mean, think about the optics of the chamber on 1-6, when the only two Republicans that are there, as reported, was Liz Cheney, the daughter of Darth Sidious. I mean, excuse me, Dick Cheney. So those are the two people that come to this, and you have Dick Cheney. Of all people, Dick Cheney, I don't even know how old the man is anymore, but you have Dick Cheney coming out of whatever vampire coffin that he sleeps in. You have him coming out, and in the daylight, I think he has some Blade DNA in him now, but he comes out, and he is the one that condemns 45. What is he, 80?
80, 81 on the 30th.
Yeah.
Okay. You got eight, and that's not, you know, in addition to the hundreds of years he lived in his previous life before he gets the blood transfusion. But you have him, you know, the Halliburton guy that had people getting electrocuted in showers in the desert. You have this guy coming out of semi-retirement or retirement, and he's the one that says, "Dang, I wouldn't even recognize this party from 10 years ago."
Yeah.
That's where we are. If that is the new normal, if Dick Cheney is now considered liberal and woke, if that is the measurement for those who follow the orange one, what does that say about that party? And what does that say about us? You know, you were talking about 2024. There is no 2024 until we get past 2022. If the Republicans take over, yes, they will shut it down. But that's not all they're shutting down, brother. This white nationalist movement is a world event all over the world. Whether we're talking former Soviet states and even Western states are joining it. So, no, there will be no 1-6 commission. There will be no actions. It all has to be done before 2022. But I'm not convinced that the Democrats are going to lose yet.
Rashi, what are you seeing? I mean, you know, maybe I'm insulated. Maybe, you know, folk have too much to lose to be as openly biased on my side of the earth. What are you seeing in Missouri? Are you all seeing
I'm actually
a spike in?
Yeah, we finna get it on here. Well, because this is what's happening. Those old guard are dead. Them old white people, those folded up, shaking white people, they walked away. And in came these young black, you know, revolutionary thought speaking, the Cori Bushes, in came some, you know, we got a couple of them here. And they like, they people who you thought, how they let you in, you know, when did they start letting people like you in? They in the chair. And they standing up and they pointing at the other people who still left with the old guard's agenda, saying, this is wrong, fix this, fix this. So here in Missouri, they didn't let like 9 or 10 black people in, black, when I say not Negroes, not colored. They let some straight up like foundational black American, real black people in. We had one, Brandon Ellington was our state rep. We have a couple, you know, that's in there, and they so strong that a couple of our what I call bench warmers, these are old black people, these are the Negroes, they've decided to go head on and move and get out the chair. They're not scared no more that some, you know, white lady gonna take the chair. They see a whole new crop of, you know, angry finger pointers like they used to be before they got put on the, you know, Appropriations Committee or the Crime and Sense Committee or whatever, make them stop being so angry and for the people. We got them.
But I was specific.
And I'm excited. They're all Democrats. None of them are Republican. They're all Democrats.
But I didn't want you to go too far. I was more asking and concerned with, are you seeing a huge presence of QAnon? Are you seeing a huge presence of the Proud Boys? Are you hearing these things in the streets? Is it being reported on the local news that, you know, recruiting efforts have been found, or there are folks that have been arrested because they had planned on causing harm or destruction to governmental property or facilities?
We
have you seen anything like that?
Our press, the Midwest press, is heavily, heavily regulated, and we don't have a lot of independent media. So when we get news, it's always about black people hurting other black people. Or, you know, or footage of people robbing somebody. They won't tell us when they get in trouble for white supremacist activity. You have to get that from independent newspapers, from local independent newspapers, because our media is completely. If I could show you an hour of our news, it's the first 15 minutes is what some black person did wrong, then some sports, some news, and then the last 15 minutes is weather. There's no real journalism, broadcast journalism being done here in the Midwest, maybe Chicago, but not in Kansas City. They totally shut that down.
Hmm. Okay. Now, and again, I say that for me, I'm not catching that. I'm not catching any of that because I don't know. I'm like, is it that there's too much to lose here? Is it that we have integrated a little better? I'm not blind to the fact that we've never fully integrated, but that's why I said a little better. Is it that there are just more outlets here where people are reporting more information, so folks are nervous about, from different perspectives that is, so folks are nervous about being discovered more easily? I don't know. I just know that when I listen to Rodney speak and the things that he shares, I have no idea. I'm like, yo, I never heard of that. And I know, Rodney, that you've heard that from me so many times. You're like, yo, what are you living under a rock? it just isn't here. It's
but,
not
but
here
Rodney,
in the manner that it's that visible. Go ahead, Rashi. I'm sorry.
Mr. Rodney is putting himself to where he can hear those independent broadcasts. He reads probably most likely, I'm sure, those newspapers and pamphlets put out. And so he's with the group that's paying attention to that. I can't tell you that I'm a part of some other than the Black National Black United Front. There's nothing that I'm affiliated with that tell me, okay, you got to check out Reddit. You got to be on 4chan. You got to watch Newsy. You got to, you know, those are the, you have to put yourself in the place where they share that information on, what is that? It's some other site they, where they, you know, where they get together and they talk about this stuff. They discuss amongst themselves what they can do next. But if you're not an honorary Black member of the Klan, or you're not, you know, married to a white lady whose brothers and uncles and stuff are into that, they don't pass it out like that.
Rashi, how did you become an honorary Black member of the Klan? I want to know that one. That just hit me and all guys.
I think his name is Daryl Davis or something like that, but he's in there. He's a member of the Klan. And he said that it's all about Southern, you know, Southern tradition and values. He'll tell you in a minute that they've divested away from being all about hating Blacks. It's about uplifting whites. And about, he'll tell you, he has a whole video rhetoric. But there are several, more than one, Black members of the Klan. Some of them white boys don't know they're some partially Black anyway. So, but the white nationalist agenda is being stoked. We do need to have our ear to the ground, Lee, just because they're not going to give it to us on the news. And very few newspapers are going to write it for us, Lee. But we do need to be paying attention. Now, how are we going to do it? I don't know. Maybe we need to do like college papers, small town college papers will do it sometime. They'll report on some of this activity. You know, if you got part of that weird crew that has a not a transistor, is it transistor radio, Lee, or the one where you could talk back to, you know what I'm talking about?
CB,
where you could,
CB radio.
You okay?
The
you
CB
laughing,
joint.
But I'm you laughing, but this is where. All right, then I'm gonna ask, let me ask better. Where do you go to find out the white nationalists? The white pathologist, I don't like to call them supremacists, where do you go to find out their agenda? I was told you have to go to places like Reddit, right? I was told you would have to go to places like a place called 4chan, right? And that there's several dark web locations with their relative names on it. That's where you would have to go, and then you would have to get vetted, and then they would share the information and the agenda with you.
So
I thought they
just
met up at that art and craft place.
So I hear you all say that, and if we think about what's going on, what's being said, and if you want to get into the origins of it, it's like somebody told me yesterday, it was before this country was started. This stuff is not new. It's the same thing. We talked about the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. The same verbiage that they used then is pretty much the same verbiage that they're using now. In the 1920s with Henry Ford, when he was gone full Nazi, again, they were talking about the same things that they're talking about now, the great replacement theory being ruled by Black people, all of their jobs being taken. Lee, you know about the Irish riots. Really, they were Irish massacres of Black people in New York City back in the turn of the old century. So all of these things have been going on forever. I gave a presentation at the local NAN meeting, and it talked about the two great compromises. The first one before this country was a country was the three-fifths compromise, when they determined that we'd only be worth three-fifths of a person for voting purposes. Well, most people don't even know why that actually was and how, in some ways, it helped us instead of hurting us. People don't know that there was another great compromise in I believe it was 1880 1886 election, when Rutherford B. Hayes, they were talking the same thing. They wanted the troops pulled out of the South so that they could re-enslave us. The same language has been updated to today, and that's what they're talking. And QAnon has also amplified it, mixed in with the anti-vax crazy. Well, yes, craziness. That's what it is. I'm calling it what it is in 2022. So I guess, Lee, what you have to do is open your ears as well as your mind to receive what's being pumped to us on a constant basis. If you need a more blunt assessment of it, then what do we think the whole Tea Party movement was about? That was it. The Southern strategy, that was it. So it's been pumped to us constantly. I don't know whether it's like the frog being boiled in a pot of water, that we've been in it so long and they turn the temperature up ever so slightly that we don't realize we're being cooked. Well, they've been cooking this stew for a long time, and one of the pops was 1/6, but that is not the only pop, and they are still in coup d'etat mode. They're just doing it slightly different now by getting rid of people, attorneys generals of states and voting officers, and replacing them with their ilk so that they can legally overturn the election. So it's there, and it's in front of us, and they're pumping it into us on a daily basis.
And you know what, Mr. Rodney, now that you say it that way, knowing that there's somebody creating some mass killing event in every city, dang near every day, I can see the context of what you mean. Open your eyes. If you start hearing information about schools being shot up, grocery stores, you know, post offices, and they make it to where there's an overall terror, just an overall terror outside of your home. This is a part of that control. Don't come out here, because it's for the big boys. It's for those who are ready to kill to get what they want. So I agree, Mr. Rodney. We are being somewhat shielded. You have to hear that. They won't tell us. They won't tell us. We find out 2 days later, maybe, that there was a mass shooting here, a mass killing here, kids got shot up here, and we are treating it as single individuals who are insane. But what we really need to be looking at is whether or not they are one of those pots you were mentioning, Mr. Rodney, a slowly boiling pot that they're making sure that they stir over and over and over again, in order to create national terror. You know, national terror. That's the fear that if you come out here, you know, in these streets, you're on our time. You're in our space. This is our country. These are our ways. And so, under that context, yeah, I can hear you. But because they have this nation so segregated, and I'm going to tell you, Kansas City is one of the most segregated, you just don't get a lot of direct influence, just short of not hiring us, maybe being the policeman that shoots and kills you in the street. But other than that, most of the white people that we see are either addicts like us, or they poor like us, and they just don't have the wherewithal to be hate-filled. They don't have enough time, you know. Plus, one of their baby daddies is black. You know, it's just always that mixture when you talk about class. So that's where I think we're having an issue at, Mr. Rodney, at least me personally. The class of white people I'm around have no supremacist agenda. because they don't have the intellect or the time to be dealing with orchestrating hate, you know. So I think that's the disconnect you find us in. The direct people around us, they love us, right, Lee? All the white people in your life love you, don't they, Lee? All the white people in my life.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
not all of them. Most of
almost
them, but not all
of them. Almost all the white people in my life, you know, and then none of them seem to have the agenda. So when I'm looking hyper-vigilantly for this agenda that you write, Mr. Rodney, is there. I've been there for so long. But when I'm looking for it like that, where's the racism at? It's become harder and harder to find in my circle. And, yes, it does hypnotize you into thinking that it's an anomaly when you see it, the way you keep seeing it in Nevada, Mr. Rodney.
But, you know, there's no further place you need to look at for it, though, than the news, specifically the South. And that takes us to the Ahmaud Arbery sentencing the other day, the killers of Ahmaud Arbery, I should say. So they were sentenced to, all of them were sentenced to life in prison. The father and son were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The son was actually the shooter in the death of Mr. Arbery. The third person, William Rhody Bryan, Jr. I'm sorry, I had to pause because I had to think of his name, was actually the person behind the video camera and the recording of the incident. Now, he was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, and according to Georgia law, he needs to serve 30 years before he's eligible for parole because of the violence of the crime. The father and son were sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Really didn't know how that was going to go. Really didn't know how that was going. The judge, though, seemed dialed in. He requested a moment. Well, he didn't request. He actually took a moment of silence in the courtroom to demonstrate the amount of time that this young man was running for his life. And he said that he wanted the people in the court to get a sense of time. And though that was only a moment, which the chase lasted over 5 minutes, he still took that time in order to give everyone a sense of time and reminded them that, you know, this must have been the most horrifying moments of this young man's life, and then he wound up dead. So I don't know what that does for Georgia. I don't know if that moves the needle for Georgia or the rest of the nation. All I know is every now and again, justice is served, you know. And
that's justice?
I don't know.
It's sad that it doesn't happen more often. It's sad that still, these were non-commissioned citizens. Commissioned in this sense, I'm meaning to non-police officers. And they are paying penalties for taking a life, where commissioned citizens are still not being held to the same accord. So I'm grateful that we had a verdict like such in this case, but it saddens me that still folks whom should know better, because they are trained to know better, are still walking the streets with little or no time whatsoever. You know, so go ahead, Rashi.
And I'd like to speak to the opposite of that, too. You know how many exonerations we have had? We own like 400 or 500 exonerations. People who have spent their entire lives locked behind bars on trumped-up charges that was not real. They weren't real. They just needed to put somebody in prison for these things that somebody said. And so far we didn't let people out.
But
some of them.
But hold on. But why are those some bodies so often bodies that look like us?
So when we start talking about, you know, people are being accountable for what they did, I'd like for us to create some kind of commission that looks at all these exonerations to see, and like you just stated, the pattern of their, you know, ethnicities and genders, and figure out why, you know, we can't do something about these people who do all these, who keep locking up black people for no reason. Let's go and retrofit that and see what's up with this. So we can, you know, make some more change, shake that cage just some more. All these little bitty pokes at the bear is eventually going to get us to where we want to be. We got to create our own independent media. We got to have our own economic, you know, standards. We got to worship our own, you know, our own ideas of, have our religious iconography and ideology reflect us. We got to have so much, you know, you got to learn. You got to teach. You got to grow. You got to, you know, it's so much work. It's so much work. But I do believe just by saying, look what you did, and making them accountable, you know, making them atone for what they did, it will make a difference. One of the things that emboldens hate is that you don't get in, when they don't get in trouble for it. If I can do real mean stuff to you and nothing ever happens to me, when do I learn to quit? I never do. I just widen my base of people to hurt. So now some dude is in the shower molesting the crap and sodomizing one of those white dudes, you know, he'll understand because he won't be dead, but he will be in trouble, you know, for the rest of his life. None of those three dudes are going to be able to just be out there happily skipping rope on the yard. Every black man who want to make a name for himself is waiting on them. They don't even have to drop the soap. They better not even take a shower at the same time as other people.
Drop the soap. You said drop the soap. Okay.
Do you understand? Because the prison is not justice. Segregation from other people is not justice, because that's what should have happened anyway with pathological behavior. They should have already been segregated. Now, they finna be at the whim. It's almost like a scary Black Mirror episode where you end up now being surrounded by the one thing you hated enough to kill. And now he's in the midst of it.
Any thoughts on the verdict?
I guess I see a victory. I don't see that things have changed totally, but I do see change. And one of the things that politics has taught me is that unless it is something crazy like 1-6, this country really, not only is it slow to change, but it's quite resistant to change, especially when that change has something to do with them not being able to be the dominant ones legally. I saw a link in a chain broken with that verdict, because what those three men basically were doing was invoking the Fugitive Slave Act. In other words, me, Mr. Charlie White Man, can go and be deputized and go and run down those black bucks and, like, use my truck like horses on the border with the Haitians. That used to happen to us, right? And round him up, and then convict him, execute him, and use my whiteness to go free. As a matter of fact, it's an insult that you even arrested me. How dare you? And they showed no remorse for what they did, which is really a dangerous thing here. They showed no remorse in what they did because it is so ingrained in them that they believe what they did was right. there is a warning in that, is that this is what these people believe, and we got to start believing that they believe this crazy stuff, because they've been acting on it forever, and now it's turned up in the 21st century on steroids. As to Rossi's point, the numbers are changing less in their favor. So I do see a small victory. I am not saying that the war is over. This was just one battle within that war. So we have to keep, hey, Robert, how are you? We have to keep pushing this so that there can be more victories. You know, I believe what Frederick Douglass says, you know, these people are not going to give up power. I'm paraphrasing now. They're not going to give up power. What they're going to do is they're going to try to hold on to power. And if we truly want the power, we have to keep pushing them to get that power. We have to keep pushing them to get the righteous verdict. We have to keep appointing judges that those where they get appointed, by ensuring that we have the right other elected officials in office. And then we have to make sure that when you elect judges, that you elect the right judges. And here's an area that we don't think about. You have to make sure that you get the right DA so that appropriate charges get brought. Hey, what's going on, Lee? We're on Facebook Live.
Yeah, I see you.
Uh-oh, somebody needs to mute.
Okay. There we go. Not sure who it was, but we got rid of the feedback. And just so you all know, because I see we all sideways and whatnot, using Facebook Live is something new. And actually, it's not Facebook Live. It's Facebook Rooms. This is something that we said we wanted to start, and we never started. So since I had plenty of listening time, I was like, well, let's fire it up and see what it looked like. So I see that we got people on the side and we got people right side up. You know, give us time to work out the bugs. But this is like progress, right? It's not always perfect. But until you do it, you don't know what works and what doesn't work. You don't know what to tweet, what to add, what to delete. And I look at the verdict. Is the verdict was a – it was a – it was a victory in one of the battles that we fight. We just have to keep pushing for more victories and reforms. And then the final piece to that, and this is what I'm probably going to end all statements with in 2022, this is people's mindset to go and hang a noose at the new sphere that they're building here in Las Vegas that is a Madison Square Garden property. A noose was hanging, right? This is the mindset that Jose Gomez, right here in Nevada at a Black Lives Matter meetup, who has a gun and is walking away from the police, gets shot and killed by the police because that's in their head. If we don't change the education system that reinforces these false beliefs, then, yeah, we will keep getting these incremental victory, but it's going to take so long to get to where we need to be. It's the minds of the people that we need to change, and you're not going to change a mind once it's been made up and hardened. It's in the formulation of that mind, typically when they are in school, which is where we have an opportunity to do that.
It's in school. And it's in them grandbabies. I asked a friend once if he had ever met a reformed racist, someone who was staunch in their belief that they were superior for any reason other than they was white and male. That was it. And he said there was only one reformed racist in his memory. And what happened is that person's daughter became impregnated by an African, and he pretty much disowned her for a while, and then one day he looked at his grandbaby the only grandbaby.
Yep.
It was his only daughter. His only way to tomorrow, his only future legacy. He had to figure it out. And by the time, you know, him and Tunde is cool now, and he had to figure out with him, Tunde and little Bobby Lola. He had to figure out what he was going to do with them for, you know, because his only way to tomorrow was through that little African baby girl. So that was the only way to reform him. If he said the nigga or spick, coon, any of that, he couldn't come to Christmas. They would cancel Christmas on his ass. So he had to fix his speech. That's where it started. He didn't talk like that. Even if he felt it, he'd say it, right? But she had to fix it too, because she could never call her daddy and say, "Tunde screamed at me," because he, I told you not to touch that film, you know. So she had to fix her in ways in that, the way some white women are able to go to the males in their life and enact them to do some things. She just can't do that. She had to stop that because he was a racist and it was bad. So. She had that example is the only example I have been told, not showed, of a reformed racist. And I don't even know if he was reformed. He just stopped the behavior, you know, around them. He stopped the behavior around those people who he didn't want to ostracize. And so I guess that's the closest we're going to get to changing our heart and mind. Impregnating and marrying their kids.
Speaking of impregnation and marriage, Sidney Poitier passed just the other day. Sidney's first wife was black as coal, like he. His second wife, not so much. She's Canadian Lithuanian. I had no idea Sidney was married to a white woman, but he had been married to her since the 70s, believe it or not, and they were married all the way up until his passing. Sidney had a lot of daughters as well. He had six, seven daughters, something like that.
He was
a player for life.
He gave me white lady vibes immediately, but what he did
You know, God daggone well, you drop a daughter first, the rule is use a player. You drop a son first, you drop a daughter first, you know you was a player black back in the day, and that was God's way of paying your ass back. Like, here you go, here's a daughter first, and then you deal with that player. You know what I'm saying? You drop six daughters, use a player.
LeVar Burton. He influenced.
And my point is made. What you trying
Paul
to do?
Mooney.
Throw me off for my point? Roddy talking about he got four daughters. What you trying to do? Throw me off for my point? My point is made. And what? I'm sorry, Rashi. What you say?
I'm telling y'all how important Sidney Poitier was to pulling our theatrical work out of blaxploitation mode, even though he too dabbled with, like, Which Way Is Up, not that other, those other movies that he kind of went in. He also brought so much, you know, thespianism, not just acting, but stage presence and thespianism to the craft of entertainment. That I just really appreciate him. Not, and people say, oh, he was a white acting, but yeah, it was a little bit Euro, but even for them, he was so classy. Like, I'm pretty sure that there are white male actors now who were using Sidney Poitier's on-screen persona. He wasn't that much different. Honestly, the man on the screen and off the screen really wasn't that much different. He didn't really fix his speech cadence that much. It's not like he did impressions or impersonations. So this real tall,
well, actually,
regal, beautiful, well-spoken.
Actually, Sister Rashi, it is that he did impressions. Because remember, Sidney Poitier did not speak English very well. As a matter of fact, he actually couldn't get acting roles because of his English. It wasn't until later on that he went and figured out how to change his dialect and learn better American English that he was able to get roles. So the person that we see and heard up until his passing, that was someone he had to learn to be. But once he perfected it, we think of him as, wow, English is so good, he must not be an American black person. He must be a foreign black person. He must not be a real black person. He's just one that they would let us have. Those types of things, those false analogies. So Sidney Poitier was a unique individual that was right for his time. And if you ask Denzel, without Sidney Poitier, there may have been no Denzel and no Will Smith and no so many others that followed him. The civil rights movement.
Not Ben Vereen. Yeah, Ben Vereen. Oh, no. The one who played Benson. Robert Guillaume. Yeah.
What Sidney Poitier did was Sidney Poitier represented what Ralph Waldo Emerson said about black people. And to paraphrase, is that we are the greatest thing that Africa ever produced. Sidney Poitier, through his stature, through his cadence, as you mentioned, his perseverance, and less, the brother was tall, dark, and handsome, right? That they were talking about black people in Europe, as a matter of fact, specifically in Italy is where that phrase, some linguistic experts believe that phrase came from, was when Hannibal had crossed the Alps. Remember, Hannibal was from Africa, and he had really conquered all of Europe, crossed the Alps, and then took over northern Italy and took over the entire country of Italy except Rome. But while he was there for 20 years, he, the locals kind of like those tall brothers that was roaming through, and they did some procreation. Well, and they called them tall, dark, and handsome. Hannibal was over 6 feet himself. Sidney Poitier, I believe, was like 6 feet or 6'1". I don't remember the exact height, but he was a tall, robust brother, good sized hands and feet, and just a good looking fella that carried himself. As they said, black people could not carry themselves. And he not only carried himself that way, but he epitomized not just what it was to be a black man, but what it was to be a man that met and surpassed European standards. And so, yes, just like those slaves back on the plantation had those slave women fawning all over them, it was no different. It was no different from Hannibal. They love Sidney Poitier. And think about the role that he played. They called me Mr. Tibbs.
They called me Mr. Tibbs.
I watched him slap that white dude across the face 4 times yesterday. I was too tickled. When he slapped the shit out of that white. That white man still gathering himself in heaven somewhere from the role. But you know what was interesting? It's not just Sidney we lost. We lost our other. He's almost the antithesis to what Sidney portrayed for us in Julian Max. So we lost the Max, right? We lost.
Hey, baby.
The guys,
it's okay, baby. We can do the same, baby. Don't you guys believe in me, baby? Can you dig it, baby? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
But imagine how deep we are that both of these men somehow were positive in our community. Like, can somebody explain how we revere one as almost as much as the other? One of us brought works like, to serve with love psychological, you know. And the other one was like, you know, don't make me slap you with my back. But they were both powerful within our, you know, iconic community. I'm trying to figure that out, why we didn't just denounce one or the other.
Well, you couldn't denounce the Mac. The Mac was what a lot of folks saw day in and day out. It was the first time that a lot of folks saw their reality on television. Good, bad, or indifferent, that was their reality. You know, again, good, bad, or indifferent, the Mac gave people something to aspire to, you know, the fancy clothes, the cars, the women, you know. For some, it was the drugs, but again, the clothes, the cars, the women, it was that's what I want to be. That in its way, in his way, that was manliness to a lot of people. And you know, in our community, we have a lot of oppression, and fighting through that oppression, you cling to anything that you see that promotes your strength, and he represented strength. He was a survivor. That character was a survivor. And you had a lot of black folks out here just trying to survive.
Not only was he a survivor, but I think that there is a direct link between Max Julian's portrayal of the Mac and Sidney Poitier in You Pick a Movie, even Buck and the Preacher, right? And if you look at, Rashi brought up a scene of where, I think it was a police officer, I'm not sure, or a detective or something, smacked Sidney Poitier. Now, think about the time
That was the rich white dude that had the greenhouse. He was in the greenhouse. In the heat of the night, right.
So he was a plantation. So the way that this movie was set up is he was a plantation. He was representing a plantation owner.
Correct.
And
right. Absolutely.
From that perspective, the hierarchy was, this is where you are. This is where I am. Oh, you mouthing at me, boy. Let me put you back in line. Right? Sidney Poitier burnt those cheeks with the quickness, didn't he? Oh no, you're not Mr. Charlie, not today. You got to deal with me on my terms as
Mr.
It's supposed to be. And did you see the look of surprise on his face? And I think it was a police officer. I think it was
Carol O'Connor.
Yeah. Did you see the look on his face when that happened?
No.
This black man. He slapped one. He hit one of us.
Right.
What? He couldn't even do anything at first. He was in such shock. Well, what I'm showing is that was police brutality. That was police dominance. The Mac was about police brutality. It was about over-policing. It was about police planting stuff on us and then charging us and telling us our fault and accusing us as a population of excessive criminality. See, I actually think the themes in almost all of Sidney Poitier's movies had some type of cultural relationship of the day that's relevant today, and that the black exploitation movies just kind of put it more into your face, where there was more great acting and theatrics around what Sidney Poitier, because you talk about clothes with Max Julian. How did Sidney Poitier dress? He didn't dress the old worn holy jeans and, you know, the coveralls with the white shirt or almost white shirt. No, he came in dressed like, wow, he dresses like us, but better, and he looks better, right? So I think the dynamic, though the way that they went about it might have been coming at it in different directions, they still were hitting the same point.
I'm trying to look up the movie, the name of the movie where he played the doctor, A Warm December. I love that movie.
Oh, you thought that was
December.
His first movie, right?
No, that was 73. That wasn't his first movie. But that was the one, speaking of the cultural references and important, that was the one when the sister had sickle cell, and he was a doctor, single doctor, the daughter, his wife had passed, I believe, and he met the young lady in London. She was a diplomat, and I love that movie. I absolutely adore that movie. I think it was a great plot. I think it was a great role for both he and she. It was very culturally relevant, you know. Obviously, she was a diplomat from a South African country, and bringing her culture into the movie and showing that on the big screen for black folks to see, it was lovely, man. It was lovely. I think that's one of his best movies, to be honest with you.
To Serve with Love.
Oh,
very
right.
Interesting.
Go ahead, Rossi.
I watched it twice. I had to watch it right behind each other because the first time it just kind of pissed me off in that it seemed like it was a redeeming, something to redeem. Like, white people ain't that bad. You just got to work with them type movie. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so and the second time I watched it, just for the actual talent of acting and kind of social control, what does it mean to change the hearts and minds of anybody, whether it be white people or anybody at all, especially the youth who have decided they're going to make their way being anti whatever is working at the time. So I looked at it and I think that his ability to pull that role off was probably the pinnacle because for the time that it was made, I wouldn't have been able to sit in there with them young people talking and treating him exactly the way that people are really being treated. It wasn't a game. At some point, they were doing real subversive, mean things, you know, in order to try to hitch that brother up. And it just happens like that out in the world. It happens that way. I thought To Serve with Love was very interesting from a young point of view, too. Like, all those young people just didn't want to be. They just didn't want to be. Conventional white people like we keep seeing every day today, but the hate was still there. That was one thing that was still there, the hatred. So I'm more interested in what you think he did in real life. Sidney Poitier, did he do any kind of Black United anything? Did he donate his money to any, like, what did he do subversively? You know, they don't really say what they do. Michael Jackson gave away a lot of money that he never told about. You know, they give this, they do these projects, and some of them they don't want the recognition, mostly because they don't want to be associated as a race person or someone who's doing exclusively positive things for their race. But I wonder, did Sidney Poitier, when he got done paying for all them beauty products with them six girls, did he find something for real for us to do, you know, for the foundation? Or even because he was from the West Indies, did he do anything for the West Indies? You know what I'm saying? What did he do subversively? I'm hoping that documentaries about his, you know, unspoken life come out later on, because I would hate for him to amass all that wonderful fortune, you know, and it not have benefited other than his immediate family.
Well, it's Brother Robert is on, and his camera is off right now, but he is steeped in I'll call it L.A. and media stuff. And I don't know if he wants to come on to the mic, but if he does, great. But until he does, let's remember that the civil rights movement and Dr. King especially probably would not have been as robust as it was had it not been for people like Sidney Poitier. Sidney Poitier, and you can throw, Harry Belafonte was in that mix also. These were people who wrote checks. They wrote checks. They didn't just say, what can I do, or yes, I'm with you. they use their financial resources and their connects to make change. All right, you want to do a march where, when, how much you need? Well, let me call Burt Lancaster. Let me call Steve McQueen. Let me get a hold of Bruce as in Lee. That's what Harry Belafonte and Sidney, and we're talking about Sidney Poitier today, that's what they bought. They bought actual checks, and they bought connect. They could pick up the phone. To a certain extent, you could say that back in the day, Sidney Poitier being not only the most successful black actor, but one of the most sought-after actors, period, he knew a lot of people. He had a lot of respect. Let me call James Garner. You know, these were all white actors, right? Because with money, with means, and also who had connections with the mainstream, and he brought that to bear on behalf of the civil rights movement. And Dr. King would not be the Dr. King that we know today. The march on D.C. may not have been the march that we thought had it not been for people like Sidney Poitier writing those checks and picking up that phone and lobbying other prominent black people, but especially white actors who could come and put a face on it that wasn't black so that it could destroy the myth that it's just these black people. You mean to tell me Burt Lancaster is saying we need to change? James Garner, James Coburn is saying Steve McQueen, Bullet? Oh, I love that movie. Let me see what he has to say. So that's just some of the stuff. And he didn't do it necessarily covertly, but he did do it just doing it without making a big hoopla about it. And I have big respect for him.
But in later life, too, the checks continue because, you know, folks like Spike Lee could go to a Sidney Poitier to get a check in order for that next movie to be made. Because, you know, Spike was bent on, I'm not going through you to get my movies made. I'm going to make my movie. And if I got to go to Dr. Cosby, if I got to go to, you know, like you said, Sidney Poitier, if I have to go to whomever, Oprah, I'm getting a check. And we're going to make this movie. And look at it now, Spike Lee's canon is incredible. it really is. I mean, he is one of the best movie makers ever, without a doubt. His stories are phenomenal, mainstream or not. And we wouldn't be here talking ever about a Spike Lee. We would not have had potentially a Malcolm X or Do the Right Thing or whatever, had it not been for folks like that. So, yeah, that's what he did.
We might have got to do the right thing, but we was not give Malcolm X without a collaborative effort between everybody who they had to all swipe their food stamp card because don't nobody want to pay for a long-term, you know, that the message, even the message of talking about the man was going to be too, it was going to influence a lot of people. It really did. So we know that Sidney Poitier was able to use his influence. What would you say would be Max Julian's legacy other than having to use his hand on the black hand side? No, I ain't trying to be. I think I just have a thing about those movies. You know, how gaining influence on our ugly. You know, not that I want it to be pretty, but gaining influence amongst us based on us being able to see what is not good about us.
But again, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. Those were the first movies that made a black face the lead in a movie. You know what I'm saying? Independent of a white person. It was that black actor was the lead, top to bottom, in that movie. There was nobody else except for him. You know, so I think that paved the way for a Shaft. You know what I'm saying? Which obviously paved the way for a whole lot of other movies.
You know,
this is what I'm saying.
So,
Superfly, Dolemite, Petey Wheatstraw. Like you say, Shaq. It's so many. Like he didn't.
Cleopatra Jones.
Black
Caesar.
And can you tell me anything real? Like those actors rarely went on to become like Richard Roundtree. Pretty much is he never pushed past blaxploitation. They don't. Those movies did not. Even though they gave us a chance to work then, they didn't. They were not a stepping stone onto better cinema. They just would. They're like bad porn, man. It's like bad porn.
Rodney, I'm sharing the same face with Rodney. I don't agree with that. I think it gave us an in to do other things. And those other things may not have been always in front of the camera, but. They gave us an in to do other things. I mean, take Pam Grier's career, for instance. You know, your boy Quentin Tarantino wrote a movie specifically for Pam Grier. He wrote Jackie Brown specifically for Pam Grier. That was her movie from start to finish. That it was all about her. It was supposed to be all about her. That movie was – that's a gem. I mean, you have Quentin Tarantino at the peak of his career, say, you know what, I have this movie and I wrote it for Pam Grier. And it's greenlit, it happens, and it's a great freaking movie. It's a great movie. So folks went on the television. As Rodney said, folks went on to influence other folks in their decision-making and or they got other roles doing other stuff, maybe behind the camera. I wouldn't say that at all.
So Sidney Poitier was also a director. You talked about behind the camera. There are very few black directors. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, Sidney Poitier may have been the first black male director that had a movie that grossed over $100 million. It was a comedy with what's the guy's name? Gene Wilder, Richard Pryor, and for some reason the name of the movie escapes me, and I watched that movie.
Not Stir Crazy.
It might have been Stir Crazy.
Because they end up going, he pretend to be blind or something. I'm mixing two movies together. I see them in prison in a roadie.
Yes.
That's how they escape.
But remember they were walking together and Richard Pryor
was trying to give Gene Wilder some black tips on how not to get molested in prison, and he was trying to do the strut right with him, but it's not right. But Gene Wilder was amazing. But yeah, I got you.
So that was black director.
Everything wasn't a success story either. You know, he also directed Ghost Dad, so, I mean, it is.
You know, hey, you win some, you lose some.
That was Bill
life,
Cosby.
Right?
You know what I'm saying?
You don't involve Cosby. He's only a marginally good actor. So, but he's real funny, though. So, we can say we got a legacy coming. Is any of the Poitier daughters, are they into cinema? Are they into film at all? Do we know?
I'm not sure. I didn't dig into them, so I'm not sure, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know either. I focus because Sidney Poitier was like a role model for me as a child, because when did you see brothers on screen in, you know, Sidney Poitier played a doctor, matter of fact, a prominent doctor. And because remember when the young lady was talking about him to her parents, and, you know, they're loving him because he's a doctor that does this and does that and bends the man. And all of a sudden when he walks in and they see him, you know, it's like that jaw-dropping moment. and but even in that movie, though, I think Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn were the parents.
Look who's coming to dinner.
And remember, yeah, remember what Spencer Tracy asked him? He says, and I thought this was a real question. He asked him, have you considered how this will affect your children growing up?
Mm.
And his response was, I forget what the female character's name was, but he says, yes, she thinks they're all going to be a physicist or a biochemist or something like that, right? And the father was just, again, almost like gobsmacked at, what? And no limits, right? And so remember, you know, we talk about Sidney having a white wife. Frederick Douglass, his second wife, was a white woman also. And
right.
If you remember what Frederick said when some of the abolitionists kind of questioned his loyalties, right? And Frederick said, of course, paraphrasing, that I married my first wife because I loved her, but I had no choice but to marry her because I wasn't allowed to marry anyone else. This woman, because his first wife passed away, basically he married his caretaker. He said, this woman has been there for me, and now I do have a choice. I'm not in the box, and this is who I choose to marry. And I thought that was a powerful statement. I thought that was almost as powerful a statement for me to read that Frederick Douglass made, that Sidney Poitier made in the movie when he got slapped, and he slapped that fella back, because that was unheard of in the day. I could see the cracks in the glass ceiling, wall, floor. I could see the cracks in it. Didn't go through all the way, but I could see it and I could feel the cracks. Because where my family's from in North and South Carolina, you didn't go around as a black man smacking a white person and living to tell about it. You might lose your genitals as well as your life, and your body parts be drawn and quartered. And so that was a huge statement in that day.
You know, I wonder what gave the studio the courage to go forward with that scene. You know what I'm saying? Because obviously, like you just said, Rodney, that had to be extremely controversial at that time. But for them to say, you know what, we're going to roll with it.
And I think about that because I've been on a binge lately watching Star Trek, right? And we all know about this first supposed interracial kiss was on Star Trek between
Uhura and Captain Kirk.
Uhura and Captain Kirk, right. But
so that's Michelle.
If you want to go to
William Shatner.
Right. If you want to go lighter, you could say that the first one was between Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, because he was Cuban and dark. You know what I'm saying? And she was very much white. So, you know.
But did he look like he was Cuban, though? Because, yes,
no,
he
didn't.
Was Cuban, but the brother didn't look. If he didn't open his mouth, you know he was Cuban.
Right. But he was darker than they made him appear on the show too, though. But anyhow, so it was like but that had to be just as controversial, my point, as that kiss. You know what I'm saying? And they fought long and hard about the kiss on Star Trek. You know, were they going to air that? Or because, you know, they aired it, cut it, and they went to commercial. It was not another scene. Right after that.
Controversial was dangerous back then because, we talked about it last week, Betty White and what is his name, Arthur Davis,
right.
They said. You know, that got
mm-hmm.
Rachel, her insistence on being what they call an ally. So that's what this name is for these people who we know they don't, we hope in our heart, they don't have an intrinsic agenda for our demise, but they're not of our race. These are our allies. And so being an ally is not an easy job. You do get ostracized.
Say that again. Say it again.
I don't know how far back to go, Brother Rodney. All I can tell you is the ally amongst us is best defined is the people who are not of our but we hope in our heart, and we really watching how they move and behave, and see that they don't have, you know, an agenda for our demise. And that is not an easy job. It's not an easy place to be, because they get the same punishment. They get the punishment that we are supposed to have for sympathizing and empathizing with us. Being in the same space really is most of the problem. But if you verbalize that you are for or not afraid of or not in a hate agenda with black people, and you're willing to become an ally, you do put a small little bitty bullseye on your back. And so I want to just thank all of our allies out there, because, Mr. Rodney, you are very good at championing your allies between the gathering and, you know, your speaking engagements. And, you know, just you're out there, and you make sure you connect with those who are amongst us that are not us, you know.
So, Sister Rodney,
for that.
Oh, Brother Bush, thank you so much for joining us. I was just getting ready to come to you, and if you want to share a little bit about some of the folks that show up to your NAN meeting this Monday. We got a couple of minutes left in the show, but this Monday at the Las Vegas chapter of the National Action Network, the chairwoman, the chairperson of the Nevada State Democratic Party came to the NAN meeting, and she sat in the back. And she sat quietly, and she observed. And I didn't know at first. I wasn't sure if that was her, but then I saw the hair color, right? And then when I realized it was her, my next thought was, do people realize the power that is in the room at a National Action Network meeting? Do they understand the power that just showed up that's an ally? Huge. So I gave away two books on behalf of Brother Bush. Both of them were by Dr. King, because we say we don't know and they don't teach us, so let's teach ourselves, right? So one of the books I gave away is Why We Can't Wait. And in Why We Can't Wait, it's a small book, but within Why We Can't Wait is a letter from Birmingham Jail for our white liberals out there. And the second book that was given away on behalf of Brother Bush was Where Do We Go From Here? Those are all prescient things and thoughts of today. But it was the fact that at this meeting, there was the chairwoman, the Nevada State Democratic Party, that wanted to join us. That was power. And we need to recognize our allies. We need to support them, because one of the things they're going to find in Dr. King's books, especially Why We Can't Wait, is they're going to find out that in some of the most dangerous places, the white people actually went in first and took the first beating. That's a historical fact. I made a post about that, and some of our white allies, because what the post was how white people, when they joined us, they knew that they were putting their lives in harm's way, even unto death. And I think I did a rhetorical question of who would do that today. And there were people who responded, a whole bunch of them actually, and said, Rodney, I will march before you and take the beating so you don't have to. Those are powerful statements. Those are the things that Harry Belafonte and the late Sidney Poitier, that's how they conducted themselves in such a manner that people were willing to separate their Benjamin and their Franklins from their wallet to empower the movement.
And I think, first of all, let me ditto what my sister said, and that you are a gatherer of people, and I love the way that you bring alliance together while still allowing us to celebrate our blackness. And I really love that. But if I can just go back a little ways to what you were saying, what the earlier conversation, one of the things that I loved about Sidney Poitier was that Sidney Poitier made it so, because he picked his roles very, very carefully. He didn't just jump into any role. And he helped us bury the old Hollywood idea that black actors could appear only as demeaning characters, yeah, like Shoeshine Boys and train conductors and Maids. I think the movie that you were talking about was Uptown Saturday Night. Uptown Saturday Night with Richard Pryor. And I think he also did Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder in Stir Crazy.
Yep.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, bringing it back to where you were, is that there have always been white folks in the movement with us, and that helped us to accomplish this movement. And we could not, in some cases, have navigated the waters without their help. And so, you know, those people that would go before you, those people that would stand before you and take the beating for you, they've always been there. They've always been there. It's just for us to not try to alienate them and not try to deny that they have to be a part of the movement. They have to be a part of the movement. And that's, I think, what we try to do at National Action Network is, you know, I like what Reverend Sharpton always says, you know, we're not anti-police. We're anti-police brutality. We're not anti-police. We are anti-violence. And so, you know, we are gatherers of an organization that likes to gather people, and we'll accept anybody in this movement, anybody in this fight that will help us fight, whether they be black, white, or no matter the gender. But we can't do it with great people without great people like you and some of the great leaders, Dr. Guerrier, that we have. I posted a picture of the OGs, the OGs that helped bring in the young people, that helped bring in other people that normally wouldn't be a part of us, and then it all makes it work like one big machine. You got to have an engine and a caboose, I mean, and a trunk and wheels and, you know, and, you know, all the different parts of the car in order for it to work.
Well, thank you, Robert. As Lee is about to wind us down, I think we're at the one-minute mark. I appreciate the kind words. That's Robert Bush, president of the local National Action Network chapter in Las Vegas that really represents the entire state. Lee.
We have 20 seconds. I appreciate you. Thank you, Mr. Bush. Thank you for joining the show today, everybody. Thank you for listening live or later. We'll rock this thing again next week. I'm still going to be on the ground. Week after that, though, I think I'm going to do a little giddy up and go. But until then, as we always end, we love you and the damn thing you can do about it. Peace.